Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a Supreme Court case that really lays down the law on when you can be on the hook for defrauding the government, even if things don't quite, pan out as the fraudsters intended. We're diving into United States v. Neifert Whiteco. Now, this case dates back to 1968, which might sound ancient, but trust me, the principles it established are totally relevant for anyone heading into the legal field today, especially if you're considering government work or really anything related to fraud.
Absolutely. Neifert White gets right to the heart of the False Claims Act, which, as you know, is this crucial piece of legislation designed to safeguard taxpayer dollars.
Right.
The core question we're digging into today is this. Can you violate the FCA by submitting bogus loan applications? Even if the government doesn't actually end up losing any money on those specific loans, it sounds straightforward, but, well, there's some really interesting legal twists and turns here.
Exactly. To help us unpack all of this, we've got a solid set of materials. We've been poring over a detailed breakdown of the case, the official Supreme Court brief, and some notes we put together to really nail down the key takeaways.
Good stuff.
Our goal is to cut through the legal complexities and understand why a case about something as seemingly simple as grain storage bins ended up having such a big impact on how we interpret a key anti-fraud law. Picture this. It's 1959. Farmers need places to store their grain, and the government offers a loan program to help. Seems pretty harmless, right? Well, hold that thought.
Not so fast. To really grasp why Neifert White became such a landmark case, we need to zoom out for a second and think about the fundamental purpose of the False Claims Act itself.
Okay.
At its core, the FCA is all about preventing and punishing fraud committed against the government. It's a government's way of getting back money that was obtained through deceptive means and, just as importantly, deterring people from trying to pull these kinds of schemes in the future.
Right. Deterrence is key. So let's get into the nitty-gritty of what happened with Neifert White. They were a company that sold grain storage bins to farmers.
Yep.
Now, back in 59, the Commodity Credit Corporation, or CCC, a federal agency, had this farm storage facility loan program. This program helped farmers finance these purchases, but there was a key condition. The loans couldn't exceed 80% of the actual price the farmer paid for the bin.
Precisely. And here's where Neifert White crossed the line. An officer at the company decided to start preparing and submitting fake invoices for 12 different farmers.
Fake invoices.
Okay. These invoices deliberately inflated the price of those grain storage bins.
Right.
By making it look like the bins cost more than they actually did, the farmers could then apply for and receive loans from the CCC that went over that 80% limit based on the real cost.
Ah, so they were gaming the system.
They were essentially getting larger loans than they were entitled to under the program rules.
So these farmers were getting extra loan money thanks to these inflated numbers from Neifert White. But here's the kicker, and this is what makes the case so interesting. The government admitted that none of these loans ended up in default.
Right.
The government didn't actually suffer any direct financial loss because these loans were all paid back. Yet, despite this, the government still went after Neifert White for penalties under the False Claims Act, a $2,000 penalty for each of the 12 false invoices.
That's the central puzzle of the case. The lower courts looked at this situation and initially threw out the government's lawsuit.
They did. Why?
Their reasoning was that these loan applications didn't really fit the traditional definition of a claim. They viewed them as just requests for a loan, you know, a conditional agreement, not a demand for payment for something already provided, like an invoice for goods or services.
Okay, so like an invoice is clearly pay me now. A loan app is more like, can I maybe get some money later?
Sort of. That kind of invoice is a clear demand for the government to pay up. The lower courts felt a loan application was fundamentally different.
Right. It was a pretty narrow interpretation, a very specific way of looking at what counts as a claim. And the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit actually agreed with the lower court, upholding the dismissal. They stuck to this idea that an FCA claim had to be a demand for money that the government already owed.
But the Supreme Court took a much broader view. They stepped in and reversed the decisions of the lower courts. They explicitly rejected what they called a rigid, restrictive reading of the False Claims Act.
Okay, so they disagreed. Strongly, it sounds like.
Very strongly. Justice Fortas, who wrote the opinion for the majority, famously said that the FCA is a broad remedial statute. This is a key legal term indicating that the court would interpret the law in a way that best achieves its intended purpose, preventing fraud, rather than getting hung up on overly technical definitions.
Makes sense. Get to the point of the law.
Exactly. He emphasized that the FCA is meant to reach all fraudulent attempts to cause the government to pay out money, That's a really expansive way of looking at it.
It is. So how did the Supreme Court get to this broader definition of claim? It wasn't just about demanding money the government already owed. It was something more nuanced, right?
Exactly. The Supreme Court clarified that a claim under the FCA includes not only demands for payment on existing obligations, but also demands that are designed to induce the government to part with money.
Induce them to part with money. Huh.
Think about that carefully. The fraudulent loan applications, with those inflated invoices, directly triggered the government to release those loan funds. Even though it was a loan and not a direct payment for goods or services already rendered, it was still a situation where false information was used to get government money flowing.
So the act of submitting those false invoices was the crucial point. It was the fraudulent action that directly led to the government dispersing funds. And this brings us to a really significant aspect of the case. The Supreme Court's primary concern wasn't whether the government ultimately experienced a financial loss.
That's a critical distinction. The violation hinged on the fraudulent act itself, the false statements made with the intention of obtaining government funds, and the potential risk to those funds.
Potential risk.
What's insightful here is the court's foresight. They weren't just looking at these specific 12 loans. They were considering the systemic risk. If false invoices could be submitted without consequence as long as no loan defaulted, the entire loan program would be vulnerable to abuse.
Right. The whole thing could unravel.
Precisely. The penalties under the FCA, even when there's no direct financial loss in a particular instance, serve as a deterrent to this kind of deceptive behavior, protecting the integrity of government programs as a whole.
So it's less about the government losing money in this specific instance and more about the principle of not allowing fraudulent attempts to access public funds, regardless of the immediate outcome.
Precisely. It's about preventing the initial fraud that could easily lead to significant losses across the program in the long run.
Okay, so the court essentially laid out a key test from this, right? What was the central question they said courts should consider moving forward?
The Supreme Court articulated the key distinction as whether a false statement is made with the purpose and effect of inducing the government immediately to part with money. That's the litmus test.
This is in effect.
If someone makes a false statement with the goal of getting the government to hand over funds right then and there, that can be considered a false claim under the FCA, regardless of whether the government ultimately suffers a financial loss on that specific transaction.
Wow. That's a really powerful distinction. So it's not just about the end result, but the attempt to manipulate the system.
Yes. And this ruling had a massive impact, didn't it? It really broadened the scope of the FCA way beyond just traditional billing fraud for goods and services. How has Neifert White shaped the application of the FCA in more modern contexts?
Oh, it's been incredibly influential. Neifert White is a major reason why the FCA can be applied to a much wider array of government programs and financial assistance initiatives, including things like grants and, very relevantly in recent years, programs like the Paycheck Protection Program, PPP loans.
Oh, the PPP loans, right.
Think about it. If someone submitted false information on a PPP loan application to get funds they weren't eligible for, Neifert White provides a strong legal basis for FCA liability, even if those loans were eventually forgiven.
Even if forgiven.
Wow. Similarly, in cases of Medicare fraud, even if the government manages to recoup some of the improperly paid funds later on, the initial fraudulent claims that led to those payments can still be subject to FCA penalties because they induced the government to part with money.
Okay.
This case really laid the groundwork for the FCA to become a much more versatile and powerful tool in combating fraud across various sectors where government funds are involved. For anyone considering a career in government oversight or white-collar crime law, Neifert White is a foundational case you'll undoubtedly encounter.
It makes total sense. By focusing on that initial fraudulent inducement, the FCA can act as a much stronger preventative measure. But I can also see how some might argue that penalizing someone when the government hasn't actually lost any money might seem a bit excessive.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
What's the legal rationale behind that perspective? Why isn't actual loss required?
That's a fair question, and it gets to a crucial part of the court's reasoning. While it might seem counterintuitive to impose penalties when there are no direct financial damages, the court's primary focus was on the inherent risk that fraudulent activity poses to government programs and public funds.
The inherent risk.
Even if a particular fraudulent loan doesn't end up in default, the fact that false information was submitted undermines the integrity of the entire loan program and creates an environment where future losses become much more likely.
So it poisons the well, basically.
Exactly. Furthermore, the penalties serve as a significant deterrent. By holding individuals and companies accountable for attempting to defraud the government, even if those attempts don't always result in direct financial harm in every single instance, the FCA aims to discourage such behavior from the outset and protect taxpayer money more broadly. Discouragement. It makes you wonder how many potential fraudulent schemes are prevented by this very principle.
So, for any law students tuning in, what are the key takeaways from United States v. Neifert-Whitecown that they should really lock into their memory banks?
There are a few really crucial points. First, when you're analyzing statutes, it's vital to look beyond the literal wording and understand the overarching legislative purpose behind them.
Right. The why.
In the case of the FCA, Congress clearly intended it to be a broad weapon against fraud. Second, Neifert-White is a perfect illustration of how the definition of seemingly straightforward terms, like claim, can be quite flexible in a legal context and can evolve based on the underlying intent of the law.
Language matters.
The Supreme Court's shift here signals a broader understanding of government interaction beyond simple contractual relationships. Finally, remember that the FCA prioritizes the prevention of fraud and the protection of government resources, and that liability can arise even if there is no proof of direct financial loss to the government.
That's the big one.
The fraudulent act of inducing the government to part with money is the central concern. So as you're thinking about your future legal career, understanding this broad interpretation of claim under the FCA is absolutely crucial.
Absolutely. So to bring it all together, United States v. Neifert-Whitecown is way more than just a case about grain bins from the 1960s. It's a foundational decision that significantly expanded the reach of the False Claims Act, clearly establishing that you can't try to fraudulently convince the government to hand over money, even in the form of a loan, without potentially facing serious consequences.
Yeah, consequences matter.
The fact that the government doesn't always suffer a direct financial loss in those specific instances doesn't necessarily shield you from liability.
It really makes you think.
Exactly. And it really prompts some important questions for the future. Considering the precedent set by Neifert-White, how might the FCA be applied to some of the newer forms of government financial assistance we're seeing today, or even to novel kinds of fraudulent misrepresentation that might emerge in our increasingly digital world?
Good question. Like AI fraud or something.
Potentially. And does this focus on deterrence over actual damages strike the right balance in protecting taxpayer funds in what is a constantly evolving landscape? These are the kinds of complex questions that Neifert-White continues to raise and that future legal minds like yours will need to grapple with.
Definitely gives you something to think about. Understanding cases like Neifert-White is absolutely essential for navigating the complex world of fraud litigation and for ensuring accountability in government programs. Thanks for diving deep with us today.